Well, folks, Gia Dave's here. Sha Jerry Adams Arish, August Arish to Silda Gomsa, Gawil Shib Shigumoy. Augustan Amateur Moy Lin Fos, so Shin Galanta. Augusta Silda Gom Nak Corum Scud Er. So Jerry Adams here, and I hope you're all well and enjoying the good weather. And hopefully, I haven't put a scud on it. Looking forward to the Antrim Carlow game, and looking forward to everything good in life. And just sort of let you know that some Comgalls honoured Eileen Howell down in Divis Street in Belfast will be formally opened next week on Thursday the 22nd of June. And in honour and memory of Eileen, the refurbished building has been named after her. The multi-million pound project has been 21 years in the making. The transformation of what was for many years a derelict building has been amazing. And all those who have contributed in any way to its success and a successful renovation should be very proud of their efforts. Just over 20 years ago, St Comgalls, which stands in the shadow of Divis Tower, had fallen into a scandalous state of disrepair. It was regularly targeted by antisocial elements, and the building was a blight on the local community and the environment. And as MP for West Belfast, I spoke to Eileen Howell in the Falls Community Council about the possibility of turning St Comgalls into a community enterprise similar to Conway Mill that could be a resource for the community and create sustainable jobs. I think it was Fran McCann who put the idea in my head. Anyway, we'll give him the credit for it. Eileen was an experienced community activist and a champion for West Belfast who put her considerable energy into tackling the endemic inequalities and injustices endured by the nationalist West Belfast community. And she was also very, very open to people who weren't nationalist and Republicans from other parts of West Belfast and believed that equality, and she was right, was good for everyone. She was irrepressible, tireless, hugely respected as a champion of the rights of citizens and of the community. She had a deep-rooted belief in the imperatives of equality and human rights and of economic and social justice, and these were her guiding principles. She was a warrior for working people. Eileen saw the enormous potential of St Comgalls, and she and the board of the Falls Community Council jumped at the opportunity to be part of its regeneration and to develop St Comgalls as a community and regenerative hub. In May 1932, St Comgalls was opened as a public elementary school and built to the design of R.S. Wiltshire, who was then the education architect in Belfast City. St Kevin's School, farther up the falls, is another of his healthy schools. And his designs were revolutionary for that period, with lots of light and air and space for pupils and staff alike. In the next six decades, thousands of St Comgalls' children passed through its doors. The building was at the centre of much of the local sporting and cultural events. Many group photographs that exist in the enclosed courtyard are evidence of the widespread use of the building by the GAA, by civic organisations and the local confraternity. And the front hall, which has been lovingly restored, was used for dances and bingo nights. Uniquely, the building bears the scars on the front wall of the 1969 pogrom in which unionist gangs led by the Royal Ulster Constabulary and its auxiliary force, the B Specials, attacked the falls and the clannard areas of West Belfast, as well as Ardoyne and North Belfast. Percy Street, which is directly, or was directly facing Comgalls, was largely destroyed, as was Dover Street a short distance away. Residents were beaten and were fired on as they tried to escape. In St Comgalls, an IRA volunteer fired on the mob and thwarted their efforts to destroy the school and to attack the houses on that side of Divis Street. The bullet holes in its front wall are testimony to these events. So in 2002, the Falls Community Council purchased the building with the assistance of Chuck Feeney's Atlantic Philanthropies, another fine piece of work done by Chuck. And those who signed for the building included Liz Groves, Chrissy McCauley, John Fosco, Meg Ritchie, Ruth Tallien, John Craven, Ailey Shrooney, and Joan Nolan. And some of those involved in the project consequently and subsequently are no longer with us, including Eileen. But those I remember include John Quinn, Marie McGuire, Sal Brennan, Mrs. Timmins, Kieran Kearney, Kieran Quinn, Claire Hackett, and Jerry McConville. Now, I'm bound to have left someone out, and if I do and if I get word about that, I will rectify it next week. Eileen and her colleagues worked tirelessly seeking long-term funding, talking to architects, developing plans, talking to potential partners, engaging with the local community. For Eileen, it was the perfect flagship gateway project into West Belfast. Sadly, 2 years later, in 2004, Eileen became very ill. She died on the 12th of June, 2004. Her anniversary was on Monday last. Her loss was keenly felt by her family, by her husband Ted, her sons Eamon and Prunchies, and the wider family circle. And her death also robbed the West Belfast community of a skilled and inspirational leader. In the years since then, the Falls Community Council has worked hard to make Eileen's vision for St Comgall's a reality. She would be very proud of the building that has now emerged, phoenix-like, out of the ashes of the abandoned and derelict ruin. St Comgall's honoured Eileen Howell is designed to promote an economic, educational, social and cultural way forward, giving the benefits to the people who live and work in the local area, and particularly to promote good relationships between communities on the Shankill and the Falls and elsewhere through the provision of a multi-use community hub. It will be an open building, a neutral space. It's a stunning building. If you want to see what it once looked like and what it looks like now, then follow link https://www.belfastcity.govern.uk/St Comgall's. You'll be amazed. So well done, and thank you, Eileen Howell and Clan Howell. Richard Gallagher, I bumped into him some time ago, and he had written a book. And interestingly enough, it was about the cinema and the unionists. So the title of Richard's book is Screening Ulster, Cinema and the Unionist. And it specifically focuses on the period from the 1980s. And from the first page, Mr. Gallagher sets out his examination of how unionism has been portrayed in the cinema over the last 40 years. And his insightful and extensively researched book and his perceptive analysis of political and cultural unionism, its sense of Britishness, of loyalism, of community, concludes that this complexity is largely absent in the portrayal of unionism in film. What we see on the big screen is a much narrower definition of the unionist identity that rarely escapes a polarised relationship with Irish nationalism, Richard Gallagher finds. He also finds that the many complications and contradictions within both the unionist identity and the unionist perceptions of the Troubles have been largely ignored. Where unionism is portrayed as well, it's been primarily through associations to Orangism, to parades, to loyalist bands, to bonfires, and through sectarian violence. Orangism and its seditions are often presented as supremacist, sexist, intolerant, and uncompromising. According to this fine author, the most dominant form of cultural expressions espoused by unionism is to be found in the loyalist bands that accompany the Orange Parades. In addition, he asserts that the depiction of loyalist paramilitaries has increasingly dominated cinematic depictions of unionists. And that's been largely influenced by the actions of unionist death squads like the Shankill Butchers and others. And consequently, in cinema, unionists are often presented as monstrous and indiscriminate in their use of violence. They are rarely ascribed as being politically motivated. Gallagher believes that the crisis in unionist identity has its roots in partition. He quotes unionist commentator Alex Kane, who said, "Because we lost the union between Britain and Ireland, because we were contained to the six counties and a majority that we knew would not be stabilised at 30%, and because we thought things would grow against us, unionism became paranoid. It became insular and afraid of everyone." It was in reality, this is my quote, not Alec Kane's, the outworking of the British colonial experience in Ireland. Gallagher also references the tensions that exist within unionism because of its contradictions and at times antagonistic relationship with the British state. Its loyalism to Britain has always been conditional. Unionist paramilitaries have a long history of links to the British military, its intelligence services, and particularly the Conservative Party. Collusion between unionist death squads and the British state has long been a matter of British policy, of strategy. However, that loyalty has rarely been reciprocated by the British state. A recent example of the dysfunctional relationship between unionists and the British government, or British governments, and especially the Tories, is the frequency with which it has been abandoned. The frequency that commitments given to it have been discarded, and unionist parties often and very publicly have been thrown under the bus. Boris Johnson's resignation last week as an MP is a reminder of one British Prime Minister who was wined and dined by the DUP and who made promises, which he then broke. Remember his triumphant visit to the DUP's party conference in 2018? Arlene Foster was delighted. Johnson was talking their language. A hard Brexit and a hard border, but then the DUP was ditched and the hated protocol was produced. There's another example of a British Prime Minister dumping unionism when it was no longer needed. So if you have an interest in politics, if you have an interest in the cinema and how it's dealt with unionism and what all this means for unionist identity, this is a book for you. Screening Ulster, Cinema and Unionism by Dr. Richard Gallagher is published by Palgrave Macmillan. So it's a good read, and as I say, it's interesting that someone would take the time and the effort to actually research how films have dealt with unionism. Now, you will recall that I did a little reading of a couple of recitations, the Sitting in Drumlister and then on another week, The Man from God Knows Where. So I'm going to dip in this week to the Cremation of Sam McGee. And The Cremation of Sam McGee was written by a man called Robert Service. And Robert Service was a bank official in Canada. He travelled and he listened to the stories and he told the stories and he produced a book. He produced more than one, I think, but this is taken from a book called Songs of a Sourdough. So here we have it. The Cremation of Sam McGee. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The Northern Lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of the Lake Lebarge, when I cremated Sam McGee. Now, Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home in the South to roam around the pole, God only knows. He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him like a spell, though he'd often say in his homely way that he'd sooner live in hell. On a Christmas day, we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your cold, through the parka's fold it stabbed like a driven nail. If our eyes we'd close, then the lashes froze, till sometimes we couldn't see. It wasn't much fun, but the only one to whimper was Sam McGee. And that very night, as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow, and the dogs were fed and the stars overhead were dancing heel and toe, he turned to me, and, "Cap," says he, "I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request." Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he said with a sort of a moan, "It's a cursed cold. It got right hold till I'm chilled through the bone. And ain't been dead. It's an awful dread. It's the icy grave that pains. So I want you to swear that foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains." A pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore I would not fail. And we started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. He crouched on the sleigh and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee. And before nightfall, a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. There wasn't a breath in that land of death, and I hurried, horror driven, with a corpse half hid that I couldn't get rid of because of a promise given. It was lashed to the sleigh, and it seemed to say, "You may tax your brawn and brains, but you promised true, and it's up to you to cremate these last remains." Now, a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load. In the long, long night, by the lone firelight, while the huskies, round in a ring, howled out their woes to the homeless snows, oh God, how I loathed the thing. And every day that quiet clay seemed to heavy and heavier grow. And on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grub was getting low. The trail was bad and I felt half mad, but I swore I would not give in. And I'd often sing to that hateful thing, and I hearkened it with a grin. Till I came to the marge of Lake Lebarge, and a derelict there lay. It was jammed in the ice, but I saw in a thrice it was called the Alice May. And I looked at it, and I thought a bit, and I looked at my frozen chum. "There," I said with a sudden cry, "is my crematorium." Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared, such a blame you seldom see. Such a blaze you could seldom see. And I burrowed a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so. And the heavens scowled, and the huskies howled, and the wind began to blow. It was icy cold, but the hot wind and sweat rolled down my cheeks, and I didn't know why. And the greasy smoke and an inky cloak came streaking down the sky. I do not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear, but the stars came out and they danced here again. I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, "I'll just take a peep inside. I guess he's cooked, and it's time I looked." Then the door I opened wide. And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm, in the heart of the furnace roar. And he swore, and he wore a smile, you could see a mile, and he said, "Please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been worn." So there are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they will ever see was that night on the marge of Lake Lebarge when I cremated Sam McGee. And I recite that in honour of my old friend, the farmer, who was a great fan of Robert Service. So, Shin A, the children gong go well to Sass till the Shin, Augustlory may lad, a race, Bunagi salt ass were la, a more or of, slan.